So, welcome everyone to one of our first episodes for Getting Stuff Done in Higher Education. I'm Fritz Vandover, one of your hosts, joined today by my esteemed colleagues, Kevin Schreiner and Kelvin Bentley. So we thought one of the things we would do to get into this podcast is to give everyone a way to get to know us. And Kelvin volunteered to go first. So we're gonna talk to Kelvin and get to know Kelvin today. We're gonna talk about his journey into, through, and around higher education that brought him up to this moment today. What are we, July 29th, 2025. So Kelvin, yes. How did you come into higher ed? Why are you here?
Well, no, that's a good question. For me, I think I've always been, I was always interested in school, definitely a bit of a nerd for that. And I didn't really plan to be in higher ed. I mean, I think originally my goal after having a really cool high school course on the introduction to psychology, I became a psychology major in college. So I guess really that was my first foray, right? Just like all of us in higher ed as a student. But at that time, because I became a psych major, I was actually very interested in being a therapist more. Originally, when I was younger, maybe because I saw too many episodes of St. Elsewhere and other, you know, doctor shows, I was really turned on by being a medical doctor. But then I think after that psychology course, I was like, well, you know, maybe that'll be a slightly easier path. I'm not sure about the whole, like, trying to be a med student and blood and guts and all that stuff. So I was like, maybe psychology is a better fit. I like the subject matter. And this whole idea of maybe being a therapist, especially with like teenagers, families, kids, that kind of interests me. So I applied for a lot of different clinical psych programs. Luckily, I was able to get into one that included a professor who was doing similar undergraduate research. He was doing research that aligned to some of the work that I was doing with a professor at Wayne State University in Detroit, where I grew up and where I went to school.
This is your undergrad. You're coming out of undergrad and you're getting into your graduate. You're on track for graduate school.
Yeah.
Hang on a second before you go down there. So what about, because I do not find psychology fascinating at all. So what about psychology in high school fascinated you?
I think it was because it was relatable in some regards, or certain elements of it. And I think because psychology as a field is so broad, because it includes, like, you know, to some extent, I feel like it includes so many other types of topics, like, showing you like how we think. There's biology and neurobiology elements. And then, you know, taking biology, I was like, oh, that's familiar to me. And then, of course, it's about people. And so once we got to, I think, abnormal psychology, I was like, oh, yeah, I can see these types of personality traits, or these, you know, potentially abnormal traits in people, and certain family members you only see now and then. So I think in some ways it just really fascinated me. It kind of just opened my eyes to, you know, that there's so much to learn about what it means to be human in so many different ways, right? Cognitively, behaviorally, like all of that. So
yeah, I think when I was in high school, my high school teacher said I had schizophrenic personality type of things like were popping up. But part of it is also, I think you just try to.
We'll get to that in the next episode.
Make people think certain things when, you know, so.
Okay, we'll get to that in your episode. Now we're going to have to definitely dig into that, Kevin. That's
that's all I'm going to say about that.
So you're an undergraduate and your interest is peaked as you're taking psychology, yeah?
Yeah, and a fun fact about me, about college too, like I you know, I applied to a lot of different graduate programs, but I actually only applied to one undergraduate program, in part because, you know, my we grew up in kind of a middle class or slightly lower middle class family. My dad worked for Chrysler for 40 plus years. My mom worked as a clerk in a drugstore, and then she ended up working for Sears as a salesperson for several years too. And we did okay, but the thing that about applying to one program, I wanted to find a way to make my education actually much more affordable. My sister, I have a younger sister, and Felicia and I actually went to Catholic school. We're not Catholic, or we weren't Catholic at the time, but we went to Catholic school because it was an actual, like, for our area, it was kind of a better educational opportunity. And because my parents invested in middle school and high school, Catholic school programming, I was like, you know, I want to find a way to not have to ask my parents for even more money, right, to go into college. So luckily I was able to, you know, I mean, I got into Wayne State, and then I was able to, find a scholarship that actually paid for all of my education. So, you know, minus books and things like that. So, So applied for different programs in clinical psychology specifically. And luckily, when I went to University of Delaware's campus and met with who was going to be my research advisor, it just, you know, everything kind of clicked. Luckily I had a couple of different offers to go to other schools, but I think it was this transition too, from like being at Wayne State University, which is more of an urban campus in Midtown Detroit, versus Delaware, where it was like, you know, more of a traditional university. Like, there were trees and grass, right? And I don't know, I think I was just, looking for that opportunity or that environment, you know, after being in the urban jungle for 4 years. So. Yeah.
So when you apply from undergrad to grad, I don't know what question I was going to ask, but I mean, so medical programs are clearly different, right? You have to go through. So for clinical psych, it's just like applying to grad school in general. So you basically just figured out where you wanted to go, professors that you had heard research about or different types of things like that.
Yeah, it was an interesting process because, you know, this was still, you know, to date myself, this was like, I graduated in 1992. And so it's like, well, yeah, right. Another thing we have in common, Kevin. And
there's nothing wrong with a 92 grad. Fritz is the one that's behind it.
Yeah, I'm 98. I'm so young.
You are very young. You're a baby. But, you know, the interesting thing was like, I just remember like, I don't even know how I found this information. I think maybe through advisors at Wayne State, but there was no internet back then, right? Or at least...
nothing not visual in, yet. Not
Right, right.
Like text-based.
Yeah, text-based, right? I remember having a Pine email address once I got to graduate school in 92. So, but the internet was still not really formed yet. So... so I think I just, you know, apply. I mean, I requested or got those little postcards, right, where you could get like, these big books that talked about different programs and then just went from there to apply to as many as I could afford. And I was told you really need to apply to a lot. I don't remember how many I applied to, but I do remember applying to several and even going to a couple schools, that were somewhat nearby. Like, I remember going to Bowling Green and some other schools, just driving out just to visit with folks and get a sense of the campus. But the interesting thing, back to our original question, right, about like what brought you to higher ed, graduate school was kind of a challenge. It was challenging for a lot of different reasons. I was on my own for the first time. The classes were, the content was definitely harder. I struggled, to really, to do well and, you know, keep my grades up. And then the therapy work didn't feel like it's definitely an art form. And our program was really cool in the sense that it didn't say, well, you have to, you know, we're not training you. No one ever said, well, you have to be a cognitive therapist versus a Freudian or, you know, like we were kind of left to kind of figure that out. Like we were given plenty of information about different schools of thought about psychology and how to practice clinical psych interventions. And it was definitely an art form. And kind of just over time, you know, after I finished my dissertation, I realized I really enjoy teaching a bit more. Like I'm more of an extroverted person in therapy. You know, I mean, your audience is usually of one or a couple or family members. And of course you're dealing with a lot of challenging concerns, which is fulfilling when you're able to help. And, but I don't know, I enjoyed being a TA. You know, I didn't receive all the money in the world to be a TA, but I was, you know, I was thankful to have some money from that. And I did enjoy working with different groups of students. I was a TA for the Rat Lab. Skinner boxes, you know, helping students train rats on different learning schedules, which I actually really enjoyed. I enjoyed doing that as an undergrad with Apple IIe computer, and then also the early PCs that we used that were attached to the Skinner boxes at University of Delaware. So gradually after I did a pre-doctoral internship at Kansas State University's Counseling Center, and then once I was done with that, I actually sought out teaching positions. So that's how I actually got in officially into higher ed as a teacher or an assistant professor.
So this is, so now we're talking mid 1990s, latter 1990s. You finish your doctorate.
Yeah.
Your PhD in psychology, clinical psychology still technically. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
So you start your on the market, you're teaching. Okay. Tell us about that, what that was like. And then, cause what I'm interested in is where you start to make this shift from that path into the little branches that start leading towards where you are now.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing with, you know, it's interesting to reflect on this. Like, I feel like this is a cool therapy session, right? We can just like, you know, kind of like think back to all the decisions. So I feel like in some ways I really just got lucky. Like, to be honest with you, I taught at a couple of different schools, two schools after I got my doctorate. And, you know, I mean, I enjoyed the teaching part, but then I was, you know, I still had to kind of figure out like to be, I was in tenure track positions, right? So the research piece, I was really kind of struggling with, like, what am I actually going to like research? And then how do I involve students? And I don't know, I was still kind of like figuring out like, what do I want to be? Like, is there a way for me just to teach without having to do the research portion? But, luckily for me, I met a woman who eventually became my wife. And when I did that, we were dating at the time. Like, I was teaching for York College of Pennsylvania, and she was finishing up her graduate degree at the University of Memphis. And then eventually she got, she went back to Louisiana to her alma mater to be a teacher. And so because we really liked each other, right, we were like, well, how, you know, we got to figure out a way to like actually like live in the same or, you know, at least 50 miles from each other to see if, you know, this is going anywhere. And so I applied and I got a third tenure track position at Northwestern State University in Louisiana, which was about 50 miles away from where where Courtney was living. And that job, Fritz, actually came with an opportunity to build what was at the time Louisiana's first fully online Bachelor of Science program in psychology.
What year was this?
This was, this was in 2001. So I had a chance. So I remember I just happened to see a job posting, I think, online for the Chronicle, and decided to apply because, you know, I used MapQuest or whatever to figure out, you know, that this
school is what's the distance between here and there.
AAA.
Exactly. Yeah. And luckily they interviewed me, and I remember I had a lot of trouble with the presentation because the thumb drive I used for it stopped working, and so I had to kind of like ad-lib all my PowerPoint notes from memory. But
oh man,
luckily they still liked me enough to hire me, and that position changed everything, right? So personally, it allowed us to be closer, and then a year or so later, we got married, which was amazing. But then that position also gave me an opportunity to be an administrator for the first time. I was a program manager for this new degree program, working very closely with our department chair. And then in the 2 years I was there, within the 2 years, she took on another position at the school. And so I became like the acting head of the psych department, which was kind of weird. But you know, so I did some administrative work there. With her support and the support of our dean, who kind of trained me up, you know, to assist him in monitoring the things I needed to monitor for that department. And it was actually the first time too that I was like a supervisor of people who were much older than myself. So that was interesting to negotiate. But that position really, I think it really helped me to grow. It helped me to start to grow as a leader more, I think. And it also gave me a chance to really do something very novel because, you know, online learning back then, I mean, schools were doing it, but it was still very suspect, right? There was no quality matters rubrics or, you know, anything like that.
So even the technology was very homegrown.
What
was your LMS? Did you use Angel or was it something else?
No, this was before Angel, I want to say. Like this was still like Blackboard, I think, in 2001.
Or old Blackboard or WebCT or even, was Moodle even, Moodle was just fresh.
I don't think that matters because, I mean, we used Angel in 2004.
Yeah. Yeah, this was definitely early days of Blackboard for us. And so... Yeah. So it was interesting. The role gave me some opportunities to work with a learning management system for the first time, but then it also gave me an opportunity to also defend a new way of offering a degree program within the state. We had to get approvals, and then we also had to submit a proposal to SAC COC, our accreditor. And so, yeah, it was a great learning opportunity for a lot of different reasons. And then, like I said, actually, I didn't say this yet, but in 2002 is when Courtney and I got married. So lots of cool things happened just within the 2 years I was there in that role. But that role changed everything because after I had become an acting, you know, head of the department and was making a bit more money, I was like, you know, I kind of like the flexibility of an administrator role in terms of like trying out new things and. Definitely like to have a slightly better salary. And so I joined the dark side of the force and became, you know, sought out administrator roles, and subsequent positions. And, you know,
So Calvin, what type of administrator roles were you looking for then?
Well, because I had that more recent experience of, being a program manager for the psych programs, online program, that's the type of position that I sought out specifically, which was interesting because there weren't, you know, it's not like every school.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot.
Role, cool, right? Yeah. It was very novel. Like we hear about it now, like UPSIA has like COLO and, you know, these cool acronyms for things, but that was not the case. I felt like Northwestern State at the time was a trendsetter because even LSU wasn't really doing anything with online learning back then. Of course, they're doing more of it now, more recently, even before the pandemic. But for me, it was like, I got a dean's position at Baker College in Michigan, and they had an online campus. So I had an opportunity to to oversee specifically like gen ed courses that were being taught online. So I was, you know, involved in hiring the faculty and doing evaluations of how they, you know, designed and facilitated their courses. So that was a great learning experience too, because again, that that chief online learning officer role just did not exist at a lot of places back then.
And a lot were tied to IT. So, I mean, was your first role, were you seeing a lot more roles in the information technology type of realm, more closely aligned with implementation of LMS versus the instructional side of the LMS and faculty training? And
yeah, no, that's a good question. I would say yes, because I think just by default, that position just exploded as more and more schools adopted that type of technology. And that's what made, I think, some of my other roles after leaving Baker College interesting, because, you know, being a director of online learning, eventually I worked 4 years as the director of online learning at a community college in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, called Northampton Community College. And I remember even back then, like, you know, the CIO was very protective of anything technology related. And so I had to work very closely with her just to say, hey, like, I want to try new things. I want to try to bring in like Illuminate Live some, you know, online tutoring. And she was very resistant at first, and in part because she said, well, you know, my staff is overworked right now. And I said, no problem. I'm going to learn as much as I can about this platform. And it's a pilot anyway, so you don't have to support me in doing it. I'll take the lead and work with tutors and train them up on how to use it. And so when she heard that, she actually, you know, backed away. And luckily I had support from the vice president of academic affairs to do that particular pilot. But yeah, technology was back then was a little bit tricky. You had to really form the right relationships, establish trust, right,
with
the teams, so that they didn't see you as a threat to their turf, right? So,
yeah, I mean, back then you were work, because I was in a very, I'm sure all three of us were, but you were working between different worlds, technology, academic, and there weren't these clear roles yet. We kind of made it up as we went along,
right?
Because, you had a foothold in the academic space. You've got your doctorate in clinical psych, you've got teaching experience, and then as you're gaining technology chops, you know, you're able to generate credibility in both. And I found that to be really important as I moved along my career. And so I think we're going to find some very similar themes amongst the three of us. So,
yeah, well, that's really well said, because I just think it's just true regardless of the position. There's not really a playbook, right? Like there might be, right, you have a job description, but there's nothing formalized, right? Like here's a book of things that you need to be thinking about, and you know, these are things to think about when you're working with faculty versus the IT team versus other constituents. Like you do have to be very nimble, and you have to be a creative thinker. You also have to, I think, be a good listener, right? And listen. I think this is where maybe some of my clinical psych skills came in handy, because, you know, like faculty, I remember at a couple of the schools I worked with were very like resistant to online learning. And really, you know, by just listening to them, their concerns, like it wasn't that they distrusted online, but I think they were just worried, like, oh my God, online learning is going to take over. I'm going to lose my job. And I feel like we're going through this with AI, right? Like, oh my God, like AI is going to take everyone's jobs away.
But to be fair, I mean, back then there was a heavy lift to do stuff online. If you wanted to capture video, it was manual. There was so much that was manual. You wanted to build stuff, it was HTML. Or you built stuff, whether it was an LMS. I was at institutions where we built LMSs. We built media for it. It was all heavy lift. So faculty looked at it and they're like, oh, wow, how am I going to do this without adding to my already full plate of tenure and promotion criteria. So
yeah. So
right. Yeah.
So Kelvin, when you look back at 2001, that first foray into online, and then kind of the things that have happened, you know, let's just say 5-6 years during that time, director of online and all those types of things. And you think now to the role of online, or the role that Upsea has kind of defined as what the colo, who the colo is and what they do. And I think the colo, when I think about a colo, I think of them being, they're just not about the LMS. They're not just about instructional design. There's so many other pieces now.
Yeah.
When you think back to like what you were doing, how much would you say that yours was instructional design, LMS, faculty development, but you weren't worried about enrollment management. You weren't worried about how many what program was going to be the right program to put into market. Like I think a lot of things that we think, it's almost like you were kind of like in the build it, they will come era, right? Like
right.
We're going to put this stuff on and we'll get to me at another point. But I mean, I started teaching online in 2004. And so those connect, like, it's just interesting. Like the things that were happening early 2004, early 2000s in online, and then what we know about online today is really just the way we manage it, right? Just night and day difference.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I mean, but you.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I never had, with the exception of maybe when I worked as the vice president of academic affairs for Tarrant County College's Connect campus, which was like a newer campus. It got started around 2014, and then I joined in 2015, where basically like that system's online learning was centralized under us, which of course caused some concerns, right? Because the other campuses, even though we were one system or one college, right? It's like, you're taking our courses and programs, right? It's like, that's right. That's in the Fort Worth area. Yeah.
Gotcha. We had that in 2010, 11, when I was at the community college in Florida, we were running the same thing because we were branch campuses or multi-campus. And it was the same thing. Oh, you're on, how do we account for FTE on our other campuses? Because you're doing online in one place. So.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably another, that could be a podcast in and of itself.
Oh, 100%.
Put it on the board.
Yeah. But, for me, I think that's right, Kevin. I think I went through a process initially where, let's just try some things with the hope that it's going to really take off. I mean, the Northwestern state example in particular was, I think that's probably the best example of that because it was so new and maybe again, maybe we can have Patrice Moulton, who was the chair at that time, who was my boss. We can interview her and talk with her a bit about like what led her to actually like do this. But she's a great go-getter. So, it's not that surprising that she went in that direction. She's amazing. But I feel like some of the other positions I held, online learning was definitely more like in place, right? Like Baker College had already established online learning. So they were just looking to grow some of their leadership team. Same thing at Tarrant County College, right? Online learning existed across the branch campuses. But to your point, Kevin, I think the colo role will still, in terms of how Upsea thinks about it, the chief online learning officer role was still not something that I really held, I think, in any of my positions, because admissions or marketing or all of, those types of more like business ops decisions were handled by other people. Northampton Community College, I couldn't actually create my own programs, right? The programs belong to faculty and deans, and they decided, which I had no problem with, because I was like, hey, you guys are the experts, right? Now, if you're trying to create a psych program, I might have some questions for you because I've been there and done that. But early childhood, criminal justice, like, you guys come to, I'll definitely support that work, but but you guys can do that part of it. And so in some ways I was actually never really like, hey, let me put it all, like put everything under me. Cause I felt like I was still trying to also build, like mind the store that we had, but also bring in, like at Northampton, we didn't have online tutoring, no online proctoring. I remember they told students, which breaks the entire model. Hey, if you need proctoring, you either need to come to campus or fill out a form and identify a proctor at your job or at your church or synagogue. And I'm like, how do you even like manage that? Right. Like, that's insane. Like we need to leverage technology more to facilitate a truly 100% online learning experience. And that experience is broken if certain aspects of that lifestyle requires people to have some type of physical presence, either with the campus or with, you know, with proxies in your neighborhood.
Wow. So one of the questions we want, and we're all three of us are going to get to this, but I think this is, it's a good one, and I'm excited to hear your feedback and insights on it, but what compels you to still be in higher ed? And you've had, we can keep going. Because I've known you quite a while. I know you have a very interesting path in, around, and I'm not gonna say outside of higher ed, but adjacent to higher ed and ed tech and other places. But
yeah,
what compels you to still be in this space, especially when we're at a point right now when higher ed is having as many headwinds as it's had in the last century, and that includes depression and everything under the hood. So that's one question we certainly want to get to and let it drive us along to other interesting parts of your path.
Yeah, that's going to be a great question. You know, it'll be interesting to kind of compare notes when we get to that point in the podcast here. But I think this is a common theme across all of us, and I think that's why we've been colleagues for so long. We can see the potential of academic innovation, whether it's pedagogical, like 100% pedagogical, 100% technology. Like we know that we can do certain things in a very cool way that can benefit people. And so I feel like in higher ed, even though it requires a lot of like time and effort and culture change, which can, as we know, takes a lot of investment in terms of building relationships, building trust as a function of those relationships. Like, I think that's what keeps me going, because I have worked at schools where we have been able to do some innovative things. And so that motivates me. I almost feel like, you know, we can relate this back to what I mentioned earlier about different learning, engagements with rats and Skinner boxes, right? Like, you know, there's, you know, in learning and motivation courses in psychology, they teach you about like, what is it called? The partial reinforcement effect, where if you do get reinforcement continuously, right, you habituate to it and you stop hitting, the rats stop hitting the lever to get food, because it's like, I can get it anytime I want. But I think in higher ed, because we've been able to actually like, you know, influence the matrix in whatever ways, right, we can bend the spoon a little bit, do some things, I think that keeps us motivated to continue to explore, well, what else can we do? And I think I'm also just driven, like we all are, about the fact that higher ed definitely needs some innovation. 20th century higher ed is way behind. Like, I feel like we're still stuck in a 20th century model, or even a later model, because of all the bureaucracies and things. We're very institution focused instead of being learner focused, as we all know. So my hope is, now that I have kids, and you guys do too, like, I want a part of my legacy to be the fact that I tried in whatever ways to influence higher ed to be better, right? And not just to be better for me, because it's not about me, it is about our kids, right? Because they shouldn't have to be in an outdated model. especially at the price points that many campuses are unfortunately charging.
That's well said, for sure.
And I'm just a glutton for punishment, I guess. I don't know.
Aren't we all?
Yes. I think you can make that argument for just staying in higher ed in general or being connected to higher ed.
Yeah.
You've got to go with the ebb and flows, right? Like, I mean, if you get stuck thinking that this is the only solution or this is the only way that things are going to be done, you're just going to run into other reasons why it can't be done that way. And you'll just get frustrated and, you know, decide you're going to not do it anymore or go a different way.
Yeah. And that's why it's great to have colleagues like you all, right, and others in our network who are doing great things. So you're always reminded, hey, right, you might get beat down. Some people might tell you, no, we can't do it this way because it's been done this way forever, or some other types of nonsense. But when you can see and hear firsthand of how the matrix, the higher ed matrix, is being shaped and reformed in new ways that benefit the learner, that really kind of keeps my batteries charged up. So
I think everyone listening should know that this is an early episode of our podcast. You're going to hear a lot of 90s pop culture references. So whether it's The Matrix or John Hughes films, that's 80s. So just get ready.
Yeah.
We'll have
links in the production notes. So if you don't know what the Matrix is, we'll have links.
Link them out. We'll create a Spotify list. We'll do whatever it takes.
Rotten Tomatoes. We'll get, you know, links to movies, tell you where you can stream it. I think one of the benefits of having been in higher ed, what I call the visual internet, Netscape, I know it wasn't the first graphically based browser, but that came out when I was a sophomore in college. That was the fall of 1995. But one of the benefits of being in higher ed, essentially when web 2.0 came in the early 2000s, late 90s, is that, and it was so unstructured and so you had to be a tinker, you had to be in there, is that you learned how to get to yes. And not just for the sake of winning debates or arguments or trying to get faculty or an institution to do what I wanted to do, but to make a compelling case that compelled, let's say, a program or a faculty member teaching a course that you can do this and here are the benefits. I think there's a huge advantage of having been back in that wild, you know, like the bad old days, because there were no there was nothing guiding you, and you had to build up credibility. And some, you know, I've plenty of experiences then and even recently getting, you know, swatted on the nose or batted down for being too ambitious or being too trying to be too innovative or whatever. So but I wouldn't trade that experience for anything, because it really taught me how to move between these what are essentially cultures inside of higher ed: the culture of faculty, the culture of academia, the culture of IT, and the tech space of higher ed, the administrative cultures, all those levels, the staff culture. I mean, even beyond IT, there's an entire different cultures in the staff world. You have to be able to negotiate them. Otherwise, you don't go anywhere. You just run around in circles, get frustrated. And then I've seen people leave higher ed over that. They're like, this is, you know, structural designers and others like, oh, this is too frustrating. And then they're, you know, they go out into the private sector, into whatever, doing instructional design for corporations.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's again spot on. I mean, I feel like, you know, in my career, and maybe you all feel the same, like it's been great to have that opportunity to tinker, to right, build those relationships, but then you don't get a chance to do that without also having the right leaders, right, to kind of give you some slack, right, give you the ability to try some things. And so I feel like at a couple of the institutions I've worked for, in particular, like Northampton, you know, having a supervisor like Mike McGovern, who is the VP for Academic Affairs while I was there, I mean, Mike was great in terms of saying, hey, you know, I'm going to allow you to do these things, but on a weekly basis, kind of keep me posted. Let's unpack any issues that you're having. But just him offering that to me meant the world, right? Because that really opened up opportunities. And not to say that it was that I was bulletproof, right? Like I still, you know, took my licks, or, you know, had to deal with, you know, faculty coming in, not happy with, let's say, not getting enough online sections because, you know, there and at other institutions, many faculty were like signing up for way too many online sections, right? And which was then causing them to neglect at times some of the students in those sections because they were teaching face-to-face and online. And that happens, I think that happens regardless of the modality sometimes, because again, we don't pay our faculty enough or well enough. And so many oversubscribe instead of saying, hey, no, let me just stick with, you know, X number of hours that, I can more comfortably cover. And so, yeah, I just feel very fortunate and learned a lot. You know, I've also been a part, higher ed is swatted back in very unexpected ways. I've been a part of Stay like reorgs. I won't name the institution, but I worked for an institution where I was hired by the provost. And a few months later, the incoming president decided to decentralize online learning back to many of the branch campuses. And so all of a sudden, when the music stopped, I didn't have a seat anymore at the table. The flip side of that was, you know, I was able to get some severance and my family and I went to Disney World. So, you know, there's that. But you know, higher ed can be a mean mother, you know, excuse my French, but, you know, it can be challenging in ways that you're not actively prepared for.
I think there's a lot of people that don't, sorry, Calvin. I think there's a lot of people that don't realize that, right? Like, I think there's a lot of people that think, oh, once you're in higher ed, you always have a job and nothing will ever change. And maybe at some institutions that maybe that is the case, right? Or maybe some.
Right.
Some role. Well,
that's the interesting
thing, right? Baylor just went through that. Baylor, I mean, just recently, you know, there's folks at Baylor that don't have a job right now.
Yeah, and being an administrator, right, you don't always have that fallback of being a tenure, going back to a tenure track role. Like once I made that leap to more administrative roles, that was devoid of anything. Like I didn't have like a tenure track position to go back to. So that's where it was tough, you know, in a couple instances. And of course I still learned a lot, still got a chance to work with people at a couple of these positions where I was there for only a hot minute. But that is something to just be mindful of. It's like just making sure as you're thinking about, you know, your next role, you know, making sure that you continue to read as many different tea leaves about where your position, how it's valued. Definitely be at the table when those strategic plans come out, so that hopefully there's some dots that connect back to that strategic plan, such that then your position is more legitimized longer term. But again, we all serve at the pleasure of someone, and if that someone doesn't want you at the table anymore, it's not much you can really do.
Yeah. And even, I mean, you know, there's the negatives and there's the positives of all those things. Right. But I think also, and I think it's one of the reasons why the three of us are together and kind of having this opportunity to do this podcast and thinking about how do people get stuff done, because we've all seen this from a different perspective inside and outside. Yeah. And have experienced it in different ways, that it does help you kind of just step back a little bit and just go, you know, there's maybe two or three ways to think about looking at this. But I do want to touch real quick, just because you mentioned the tenure track. Do you regret not doing enough to get tenure? Like, if you think about your career now, where you are,
yeah,
the length of your career, do you regret that you didn't take the time to finish a tenure track role, have tenure, so that later as you go into these administrative roles, and granted, you had no idea where you're going to go, but if you think back,
right.
Would you have said, I really wish I would have stuck it out and done that tenure track role to have that? Or for you, did you think does it really make a difference?
No, that's a great question. It's in large part because I don't think I have been asked the question, and I don't know if I've actually reflected on that decision to leave academia in terms of being a professor behind. I think for me, it felt right. You know, starting back at Northwestern State Forward, I think probably one of the things, if I could go back and do differently, because I have been able to do some like part-time consulting kind of in between jobs as I've been looking, like I wish maybe I had done a bit more of that even earlier on, just so that I had that experience. Now, granted, you know, when you're already working 40, 50, 80 hours a week, you don't always have time for side gigs, you know, even though sometimes I'm like, man, maybe I should get an Uber, you know, just to have some money to give to my kids when I ask for gas money or whatever. Although we have electric cars, so gas money is irrelevant. It's more about other things they need. But you know what I mean? Like it's hard to find that extra time. But I think now as I'm getting older, it would have been great to maybe just have, you know, maybe if explored even more those opportunities such that within my network, I would have maybe had an easier way of finding some part-time work in between. Because I think when my job went away at the one school that I referenced earlier, where I was hired and then fired, and even the HR director was like, why did we even hire you? Like, I feel so bad this happened. It would have been great to add that consultancy base to fall back on. But I don't miss the teaching, you know, having a tenure track role, because I felt like that wasn't the right fit for me. And I feel like the administrative roles I've held ever since Northwestern really, I think, solidifies that.
I think you're going to find that amongst the three of us is that one of the reasons we're in the spaces we are in this intersection of higher education and technology is that maybe we pushed back on that notion of faculty path is the path. If you want to be in higher ed, you want to be faculty. So when we get to my episode, you know, I was never in a tenure track role because my initial PhD, I never finished. I stopped at the master's because I really saw that I don't think I want to go this path. I see a much more interesting one in this intersection of, at that time, history and humanities with technology. So in the context of higher ed. So I think we're going to find that we're old-ish, and yet we've been in this space since its infancy in the late, for you two, early to mid-90s. For me, it was, you know, right around 2000, 99, 2000. So I think we're going to find that a lot. And to me, there's lessons to be had there, you know, about pulling strings, even when it's just a teeny little spider web, you see it and you start pulling that thread. And not that it always works out, but it makes for an interesting path.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And even with, you know, with your kids, my kids, all of our kids, like, especially now that I'm involved within the University of Texas system with micro-credentials. And like, for me, I want to be able to just help higher ed, and maybe starting with my own kids, help them realize that there are multiple paths, right? And you may not go to college right away. Maybe it starts with a job or an apprenticeship or, you know, whatever. But we have to kind of get outside of our bias, right? That college is the only pathway, or being a professor, right, is the ultimate opportunity because you can have a job for life, right? Whatever that means. Or even being an administrator, right? Like we have to kind of just through, like, what are the spaces in between the paths that we may want to explore and figure out, okay, what are the new paths that we can kind of cobble together, different experiences? And so maybe the path is really a tapestry of different things, right? Your full-time job, right? Ongoing professional development, doing volunteer work, you know, or doing a consultancy, if you have the approvals and the time to do it. So maybe it's that we need to make sure, just to help us all be well-rounded and for the 21st century world of work, you know?
I agree with you. You know, it's interesting. We just came back from the FCEA conference, and there was someone there that, and you don't hear it a lot, I don't think, from a lot of administrators, where, you know, I I've been at five, you know, this person, I've been at five different institutions in like 10 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, and I've even shared this with other people that I've mentored that are thinking about how do I evolve in my role, or what do I do within my role? And sometimes my response is, have you looked at doing it outside of the current institution that you're at? Like, have you thought about going somewhere else to gain some other knowledge and to get some more information to broaden your depth and reach of who you are? And I think sometimes we just get locked into this that, because again, I think higher ed puts that perception of you're going to work here for 40 years and you're going to retire and you're going to, and life will be great. Maybe, but I also don't think there's anything wrong with going to multiple institutions and, you know, having those interactions with other people. And especially like, I think about all the places where you've gone, like you've gone from large city, right? Detroit to Delaware, and then to the South, and then around, and then back to the South. I mean, we can call Texas its own country if we want to, but you know, you know, and so you're not only getting the experiences of the different places that you have been at, but you're also getting different perspectives because of the regions that you've been in and the people that live in those regions. To your point, the community, volunteering in the community, part of the community, like all of that is kind of, it shapes the way that we also think about things. And I think sometimes we can get very much blinders on and we only can see what we deal with on a day-to-day basis and don't realize that there's other things going on. And there's, and for some people, there may be better opportunities somewhere else if they'd be willing to take that leap of faith and go do that.
Right. I mean, I'm finding higher ed, and so I turned 50 this year.
Congratulations.
Secrets Yay. Out. But you know, so I've been in higher ed a good 25 years now as a staff member and with stints in graduate school and in some adjacent to higher ed, but I'm noticing in a lot of ways you have to move, you have to step out to move up. If you want the steady progression up through an organization is not, and not that it was always the case that that would happen, that you would, like the 40-year career at one institution, you just move your way up. But internal promotion is not always, it's not always easy and it's not always clear. And what I would tell myself looking back is don't wait. Don't when someone's like, oh, just, you know, it's going to happen. Just wait, just wait. When someone says just wait in an institution or in whatever, in any job you have, that means be wary. Because it often means I don't want you to move up because of whatever reason. I'm intimidated by you. I don't like you. I think you're better where you are from their positionality. You know, you're a good worker and I don't want you to move up because then I don't get you good work in my, in that niche anymore. So, yeah.
But I do think it's a different conversation from an administration standpoint from, or from a faculty standpoint.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I think a faculty member, it's easier to stay somewhere for 40 years because you can do that, you know, 5 to 10 year track role. And then you can become a department chair, and then you can become an associate dean, and then you can become a dean, and then you can become a VPAA. Like there's a path, like there's a way for you to kind of, or you can just stay a faculty member, but there's a way for you to kind of do that. I think when you step into administration, you're exactly right, Fritz, that it's hard to step into an assistant director of admissions and think someday you're going to be the vice president of enrollment at the same institution. Right. Like that trajectory really isn't there.
The first time I really started seeing that was in the mid 2000s. I spent about a year and change, and some before that in a consultancy space, but working for a small company here in the Twin Cities. One of the reasons we came up here in 2005, a company called the Lawler Group that did marketing and communications for mostly smaller private institutions. And I worked with John Lawler. He was a great mentor. He's still a great friend. He lives pretty close to me. He's retired now. I remember seeing admissions people that we worked with at different institutions. They were moving all over the place. They were on the move. You know, this person was an assistant director, and then all of a sudden they're down at University of the South and then up here and over there. I'm like, whoa, this doesn't look like what I'm used to seeing in higher ed, which is a steady. And I think I was looking at it through faculty lens of tenure track to tenure. Mm-hmm. So you're associate, then you go for full. And then maybe, like you said, you become a chair and an associate dean or dean or whatever. So I remember back then thinking, wow, the missions people are all on the move. Yeah, move in and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, it's interesting now to think about this, and I'm glad that you both of you are helping me kind of process this a bit, because
we're here for you, Kelvin.
Yeah, no,
we can be your counselors. As much as we despise
this psychology, is a safe space, we're going to broadcast to everyone who wants to listen. It's all good.
No, this is excellent, because it's like a catharsis, but then it's also like, I feel like in some ways, this is like we're unpacking just one small aspect of a dirty little secret in higher ed, right? That you have to follow these prescribed paths. And maybe the dirty little secret too is that higher ed needs to do a better job of succession planning. Like, it needs to figure out what these new paths are and to really kind of help people navigate that and support them perhaps more. Oh, yeah. And not be shocked when someone is like, you know, reached a point where they're like, they want to do something differently, and they're told, no, your experience doesn't match the next plateau. Like, we need to be supportive of folks, right? Like, even if that means they need to leave, we need to find a way to assist, right? And maybe a part of that is just ongoing continuing education opportunities and professional development opportunities, and to celebrate when someone does leave. You know, we don't always do that. We're like, you know, kind of going through the five stages of grief or whatever, but we need to find a way, I think, to be more supportive and to also maybe think about, like, how can we develop, let's say, a COLO, for example, right? Chief Online Learning Officer role. Maybe there are some newer roles that need to have a seat at the larger tables. Now more than ever, as schools are really trying to figure out, are they going to be around for the next 10 or 20 years? Because students, enrollments can be much more fluid, especially in places like Pennsylvania, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Where we're, you know, and Kevin, you can teach tons of graduate courses on this, right? About demographic cliffs and things like that. So.
I think we need to have an episode where I do have another question for you, Kelvin, but we need to have an episode that's best and worst advice in higher ed you've ever gotten, like the snippets. Someone told me, without naming names, of course, but we could have a call-in show for that one.
Yeah, that'll probably be a better call-in show. Yeah.
It would be like car talk. So we're talking about all this professional development and reflecting back, going forward. So what's next? For you?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I mean, my hope is that I can kind of just in general, regardless of what happens in terms of positions and things like that, I still want to be very active in the academic innovation space. And I think there's just so much more to do. My hope is that I can continue to also, now that I'm doing more stuff around like workforce development and work-based learning, I want to do, I think, more of that work in particular. I think in part because I have gone through different job moves for different reasons. I've lost the opportunity to have a job a couple of times, as I referenced before. So I've been unemployed, so I know what that's like, and it sucks. And
it does
suck. And so I would love to be able to kind of contribute to any work that will help better prepare college students, or just people in general, people even outside of college, to be ready for whatever this new world of work is going to become, especially with AI kind of disrupting at times things even more. In more dangerous ways, I think. But potential, I think there's still opportunity with AI, but I think there's a lot we don't know. And so we need to find a way, I think, to really just help our students be prepared for it and how their lives will be impacted by it.
Yeah, AI, I think, is definitely going to be the next 5-year change to higher ed. I mean, I think it's having impacts now, right? But I think we're really going to see it in about 5 years. It was interesting. Georgia Tech did a presentation at the conference and they're integrating AI into the LMS. And, you know, Georgia Tech, I mean, predominantly, I mean, their programs are run more MOOC-ish than they are traditional LMS, right? So but they're integrating this AI that basically when you do your introduction of who you are in the class, this AI will go through and find people with similarities or geographically where they're located or whatever, and they'll send an email or a text to this to both students and say, hey, Fritz, you might be interested in connecting with Kelvin because Kelvin is also interested in mountain biking and he lives in New York. I just think that's amazing, right? Like from a community, to build community. But it's also Georgia Tech, and how far off is that for everybody else? Right? Like they're building this
and themselves. Finding a way to protect everyone's privacy, like giving people the opportunity to opt in as well. Because it could also have that creepy vibe, like, wait a minute, like, why are you in my DMs all of a sudden? You know,
get out of my private life.
Yeah,
I'll make my own friends. Thanks, Hal. Exactly. What are you doing, Kelvin?
Yeah, like, wait, what?
See, this is the late 60s.
Robin, are you busy tonight? 90s or 80s.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. But I think there's lots of opportunities out there. And so those are the things I want to be doing and want to help my kids find the right path for them. That's affordable. And selfishly, I don't want my wife and I, Courtney and I, to take out a second mortgage. So if I could find a way for my kids to go through college mostly debt-free, that's what I want to prescribe and give them different options. So that they can make the most informed decisions for themselves. So I think that's also what's going to be next, especially since, you know, our daughter Kate is 15. And so college is just around the corner and our son Curtis is 11. So hopefully we'll have a template of things that we can pass down to him after we set up some things for Kate.
Well, so. Kevin is he's our guide. He's got grown, like, I'll say this because it's our podcast and we can bleep it out. He's got grown-ass kids.
I have grown-ass kids. I have a grandchild. So
grown-ass
children and a grandbaby.
Wow. Well, I got married when I was, I was older when I got married. I was 32 and then Kate wasn't born until I was 40. So.
Yeah, we were much earlier.
Yeah.
I'm right in the middle. Got married at 30, first baby at 30, just about to turn 33. So, but what else is there to tell about you, Kelvin? What should people know if we're listening, people listening to the podcast and getting to know us, what are some other ground truths?
Outside of work stuff, what should people know about you?
What do you like to do? Now, what do you do? What do you like to do?
Well, I mentioned a lot of sci-fi references that some people are going to be like, what? Like, what is he talking about? So big sci-fi fan, like to travel, trying to, you know, given the fact that I have younger kids, trying to stay in shape with walking and running. I've done some half marathons, two full marathons.
Shoes do you wear, Kelvin? Because maybe
I'm a Brooks guy. Brooks Ghost.
Yes.
17. Brooks, there you go.
It's my current
one. Brooks, if you're listening, we have a runner, active runner.
That'll make my good Brooks friend Kara Goucher very happy. She's an Olympian she works with Brooks. So I'll drop that to her and she'll be very happy to hear that.
Yes. And, you know, if anyone's from working for Brooks, click and subscribe, you know.
That's right. Smash that like button.
But yeah, those are the things. Definitely like to travel with family and also just collaborating with folks. And if anyone wants to connect with me, my LinkedIn information will be available. I'm just excited that we're doing this podcast together. It's been a dream of mine to get together with cool colleagues like yourselves. And so looking forward to our upcoming intros for both of you and our upcoming guests down the road when we have them.
Indeed.
Yeah, it's going to be good. It's going to be good.
Well, with that, I think this might be a good time to call it an episode. We thank everyone for listening. and we'll see you next time.